host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockeypedia Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy Thomas Drans. Tom, what's going on, man?
Not much, man. Game two, let's go. Beautiful day here, too.
It is a beautiful day. I had in my notes here, we're coming off the thriller from game one. We were supposed to record on Thursday, fresh off of game one. We have to push it back to this Friday morning, so hopefully people will still have time to listen before tonight's game two. But it was a thriller, right? And you were in the house for it. The crowd was certainly electric as that comeback was taking place within that 5 minute span or so.
Loudest I've ever heard that building.
So the Canucks come back. If you somehow are waking up from a coma, you missed what
happened. Wednesday's game one.
The Canucks came back. They were trailing 4-1, kind of late in the second, come back, then score three goals within a 5 minute span in the third to take game one. Let's get into all of it, both from the perspective of kind of what we saw from game one, but also I think maybe even more importantly, what's sort of actionable, I think, for the rest of the series, right? Because regardless of the result, this seems like it's shaping up to be a pretty long, highly competitive series. And so I think there's a lot for us to unpack here as you roll your eyes as I said that.
Well, I just bring me length, bring me more games in May. That's what I'm here for. No, the Canucks outplayed the Oilers so thoroughly 5-on-5 throughout that game. I mean, with the exception of the first period where it was like 50-50. Like Vancouver started to really pour it on, and you know, it's just hard for me to know, I guess, after one game, like, I'm not shocked that the Canucks can skate with the Oilers, right? Like, that doesn't shock me, given how we've seen this team play 5-on-5, what we saw them do to the Nashville Predators in round one, a team that I actually think highly of. Like, I don't think that was, by any means, like, a soft first-round opponent. I thought the Canucks were able to bottle them up. I thought they were able to, for the most part, manage at least a narrow edge in the run of play, 5-on-5. So I didn't think the Canucks were going to get blown out of the water at even strength in this series. But, you know, as the night went on, it was pretty clear that the Canucks were able to skate with them to the point where they were having what looked to me like sort of a message sending second period until the Oilers got two consecutive bounces, like within the span of a minute, one off Ian Cole's knee and one off Tyler Myers' stick, both of which end up beating Artturas Seelovs. And, you know, at that point, 4-1, certainly you're thinking the Canucks are like dead despite having played well. And then I don't know what it is. Well, sorry, I do think I know what it is in this case anyway. Like what the Canucks did in game four against Nashville, right, was just a sort of incredible accumulation of skilled plays by four guys, no weak link among them, right? Hughes to Pettersson to Besser to Miller, or Hughes to Elias Lindholm to Besser, and boom.
Yep.
They sort of steal game four. But really, I don't think you can understand what happened in game one of this series without specifically talking about it as a Stuart Skinner meltdown.
Well, I thought it was interesting after the game. It's always tough to parse comments from players after a game like that, because there's a certain level, I think, of face saving that goes along. Like, you rarely see someone just completely open up about like whatever had unfolded.
Yeah, what's being said privately in the locker room is usually a lot different.
Yes. So I think Mattias Ekholm had a comment where he was essentially like, yeah, we felt very good like with the way we played. We felt like we controlled it or whatever. And I actually do think for the first half of the game, even though the shot count was low and they weren't necessarily generating much themselves, and in theory, it was much more sort of in line with that Canucks game environment that we talked about in the Predators series that I think they'd prefer this to be played at. I do think the Oilers were fine for the first half in terms of the way the game flow was going.
Well, if they play that first period two more times, second and third period, they're winning that game, no question.
Yes.
Right? It was somewhere along the line in the second period, they just stopped generating. And I just, again, I, with one game in, it's hard for me to know how much of that was like the Canucks shut down the Oilers and how much of that was
score effects of being up 4-1.
Score effects, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, and to taking their foot off the gas. Now, what I will say is I had the scoring chances in that game 19-14 for Vancouver.
Yeah.
14 scoring chances for the Oilers. In round one against LA, they averaged 25 by my count.
Right.
And that's really encouraging.
Yes.
The other thing I will say, and it's kind of becoming a bit of a concerning trend for the Oilers from my perspective, is as that series against the Kings went along in games 4 and 5 in particular, they stopped generating anything at 5-on-5.
Right.
And I kind of posited the theory that part of it was not them playing down to their competition, but sort of realizing how much they had to do to get across the finish line against the quality of their opponent, and then just being willing to embrace that type of game, almost like to prove a point that they can, you know, because there's been so many years where like, oh, well, the Oilers, when the going's good, they can score a bunch of goals and they can play in these high scoring games. But in this quote unquote playoff environment, if it becomes a 2-1 kind of rock fight, are they comfortable being in the deep end there? And I think they almost, to prove a point, played that type of game and then scored a bunch in the power play. But I think 5-on-5 were willing to play that. We kind of saw that again here. And I'm not sure. I think they can win that way, but I'm not sure like it's in their best interest to be embracing it in this series.
Well, and I actually thought one of the things they did best was make some choices, especially in terms of the defensive zone coverage, to incentivize this game to have flow, to create pace in the game with some of their sort of tactical choices overall. Now, first of all, what you're talking about with the Oilers playing down to their competition or trying to prove a point, like, there is something about this team, right, where based off of what they can do at the top of the lineup, based on how the Ekholm-Bouchard pair play, you know, based on just the top six, the fact that, like, I have time for their third line, even though they have some tendency to get caved in 5-on-5. Like, I look at this Oilers roster and I think you guys should be, and in fact are, on true talent, if not the best team in the league, one of them, right? And yet, I have zero trust in their ability to just sort of play that way without moments where they kind of F around and find out.
Yeah, lapses.
Lapses and focus, lapses. And so I do think that's partly the story in game one. Not unlike the story of their second game of the Kings series, where, you know, they come out, they trounce the Kings so decisively in game one, and then they're down 3-1 at the end of the first period, and it was, you know, maybe the worst 20 minutes we saw from any team in the playoffs. And it was just like, you guys think this is going to be easy. Like, I don't know why this team seems to need these reminders, but they, all season, the whole first month of the year, right? It's like, this team seems to struggle with maintaining focus, and against a you know, pretty disciplined, try-hard group like the Canucks, I do think that's dangerous.
It is. And let's get into the specific details of what happened in game one and what I think is a big sort of thing for us to hone in on and watch into game two and beyond. Okay. And it's this. It's the matchup that I noted in my preview, the highest leverage point of this series beyond Oilers power play against anyone, because if that gets opportunities and is cooking, it's game over for you, is Connor Garland against the Cody Ceci, Darnell Nurse pair.
Yeah.
And
he got loose.
Well, what I noted in, and this is what I love about the postseason, you know, we talk about kind of like how like this concept of styles make fights. If you're going to go on a long playoff run, generally your best players will have to do something in every series, but it feels like based on the opponent and kind of the terms of engagement of how a specific series is going, certain players are going to be more well-suited for one series than another, if you know what I mean, right? Like, you might have a quiet series in the first round and someone else kind of carries the load, and then round two, all of a sudden it switches and a third line or second line kind of
just
takes
like
the reins.
JT Miller caped up for the Canucks in round one, but now that he's chasing around Connor McDavid, it's going to be an awful lot harder for him to carry sort of the mustard offensively in this one.
Yeah, so I think in that round one series, that Joshua Garland, Lindholm line had a great game one, right? They were kind of the reason they came back in that third period.
Yeah. And they had moments where they scored clutch goals, but overall they didn't.
Well, for the series, I think they were on the ice for like three Canucks goals in about 75 5-on-5 minutes in that series.
Yeah, but four against.
But four against, and I think their main head-to-head matchup was the O'Reilly Preds top line, I should say.
It was something of a soft match, but yeah.
It was, but I mean, like, in terms of the actual,
for sure,
whatever the volume, in game one, they were on the ice for 3 5-on-5 goals for the Canucks in just like 11 or 12 minutes that they played.
Right.
And all of that came against Darnell Nurse and Cody Ceci.
Yeah.
And the reason why I thought it was so interesting was, obviously, that combination got put together with Lindholm late in the year, but Joshua and Garland had been so successful for this team all regular season, right? We're kind of quietly their best 5-on-5 combination and their biggest drivers. You watch that Kings series against the Oilers, and Ceci and Nurse struggled so much with annoying speed, basically, as I would term it, like guys who would just relentlessly attack them, because I think their biggest flaw and the reason why they make some of these like low light mistakes that wind up on highlight reels against them is because once they're pressured into making decisions like that, they have that lapse in judgment that you just mentioned. Like, they constantly just make bad reads. And a guy like Garland can kind of force them consistently into those situations, right? That's why Arvidsson and Lizotte and guys like that had success against them.
Right.
And that's exactly what we saw, especially on that last goal, right? Like, where Garland takes it and kind of exposes that. And so we saw that play out in game one. And that's something that I think you have to keep coming back to as, like, the most exploitable thing for the Canucks. If the question is going to be, can this team score enough to keep up with the Oilers? They did in game one, and that's the reason why.
Yeah, and look, I'm out on I'm out on Nurse CeCe as, like, a championship caliber second pair. I was before the deadline. I thought their biggest area of need to upgrade was second pair RD, and I actually really like CeCe. I just think they need something a little bit different, given how Nurse profiles, right? Given you know, my view that realistically what you need is, like, a defensively oriented speed guy. It's why I liked the Sean Walker fit in my mind's eye anyway so much for the Oilers. But Dakota Joshua's goals off a offensive zone draw ricochet off the end boards, right? Elias Lindholm's goal is scored by Jeff Skinner as Lindholm just kind of hopefully puts the puck into the crease from behind
Stuart
the net.
Skinner.
What'd I say?
Jeff Skinner.
I know.
Who has never scored a playoff goal. No, famously.
So Stuart Skinner, you know what? I keep making that mistake on radio. It's a big problem for me in this series.
I love the irony of it, giving Jeff Skinner playoff goals.
So Stuart Skinner scores on himself. And then, yeah, you have the breakdown. But even then, like, I think it's the Oilers caught sleeping that the Canucks were able to execute, like, manufacture a partial break over 180 feet of ice from, like, effectively a stationary set.
Yeah.
But it's not a great angle shot. And that's a breakaway move that Connor Garland tries, like, 12 times a year, and it works once. You know that?
It is, but if you followed any of Kevin Woodley's work, the one way you can attack Stuart Skinner is getting him moving particularly off the rush.
Yes.
That's where he struggles, and that's why this was an interesting matchup, because the Canucks, they were 32nd in the league in rush chances in the regular season. I think it was like 4.9 per game, Sportlogic had them.
Right.
They averaged 3.6 rush chances per game in round one against Nashville, and that feels wildly inflated because I watch those games and I do not think they average nearly four rush chances per game.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering, in this type of series, that's the biggest weakness, clearly. Are the Canucks going to be willing to kind of... These rush chances sometimes for them, and we talked about this in round one, are like a water in a desert mirage for them, right? Where it's like, it's there for you. I think they could have more rush chances, but part of why they're so good defensively is because they're so disciplined about resisting that temptation. And in this series, they might almost be incentivized. And obviously, in a game environment like game one, you kind of do have to push for it a little bit more.
Right.
And so I want to see more of that, because I think that is one way you can attack Stuart Skinner and take advantage of his weakness.
My point being, though, that while I have real concerns about Nurse CeCe, especially against a player like Connor Garland, who's really a top-of-the-lineup caliber player who, because of his size, tends to play far less than that, you know, if you're looking at the tape as Chris Knobloch today or yesterday, are you really that upset with the chances they surrendered? You know, I feel like I'm looking at those goals most likely and thinking, I mean, I need better for my goalie, and there's a few bouncers in there.
There is. I would say, though, what was it, early in the first, that pairing falls asleep and Connor Garland gets a wide open breakaway
from,
like,
true.
Center ice on. There's no one even close to him. The Joshua goal is a lucky bounce off the end wall. If you go back and watch it, though, I have no idea what Cody Ceci's doing. He's, like, kind of wandering towards a point, then realizes Dreisaitl's already covering that guy. And if you look at it, it's a 2-on-1 down low for the Canucks to take advantage of that rebound. And then the third one, or the game
also,
winner.
The Canucks are going to shoot from the point to generate rebounds. Like, come on, man.
Yeah, and the last one is they're kind of just standing flat-footed, and obviously I think they're surprised by the fact that the puck came up that quickly.
That last one was tough.
All of them are tough, though.
Yeah,
and this is
right.
A recurring theme. I mean, this postseason, with CeCe on the ice 5-on-5, they're down 8-3. When he's not on the ice, they're up 12-8. Like, I don't know. Sometimes small sample goal trends can be deceiving. In this case, I think we're working with large enough sample here where, regardless of how those goals were scored, those opportunities will come for the Canucks, assuming this happens. And I think this head-to-head will happen, and we're going to talk more about Draisaitl's health here in a second, but the way Knobloch runs his five-man units is Bouchard and Ekholm play primarily with McDavid.
Right.
And then Leon Draisaitl's job, and this is why I thought he had such an underratedly amazing season. Everyone was like, oh, his pace is a little down from last year. It's like he's playing almost full-time with Darnell Nurse and Cody Ceci, and he's just dragging them around the ice. And so the Canucks are going to go, it looks like, with Lindholm versus him because they don't want Lindholm versus McDavid.
Yeah.
And actually in game one, the times McDavid had success was against Lindholm at 5-on-5. And so we're going to see that head-to-head, at least in these Vancouver games.
And a way firmer hard match for, especially for Canucks forwards, Miller against McDavid, with Rick Tocchet having last change, way firmer hard match than Tocchet typically does. Like, it's JT Miller versus McDavid, no question about it. From a Canucks perspective, we come out of game one knowing exactly what Tocchet thinks because I think Miller had like three shifts against the next sort of most frequent opponent, 5-on-5. Like, he's out there when 97's out there, period.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a dynamic to watch all series.
Well, yeah, 11 minutes of McDavid's 19 of 5-on-5.
Yeah.
And the shots were 4-1 for Vancouver at the time in Miller versus McDavid. The few shifts McDavid had versus Lindholm, I think he actually did have some success. And so the Canucks would be wise to steer clear from it. And that's what makes Garland and Joshua and Lindholm not only creating these opportunities, but converting on them so important. Because in round one, so much of the offense revolved around JT Miller. And even in this game, right, he scores that sick tip at 4-on-4 to kind of help them in the third period.
That was a sick tip.
He still had, I had 7 of the Canucks' 19 scoring chances were contributed by him, either taken or set up directly. Yep. So like he was still so involved in the offense. But if he's going to be playing more than half of his 5-on-5 minutes against McDavid, I don't think it's fair to expect him to carry that much of the load offensively as well.
No.
And so like we'll talk about Pettersson here in a second in his line. But it will come down, I think, to how much Garland's line can expose the second Oilers pair.
Well, let's talk about one qualitative factor that was so noticeable with Besser and Miller on the ice was we knew that the Canucks would want to play keep away in this series and spend as much time just holding the puck in the offensive zone and making extremely conservative puck management decisions as they can, especially in those Miller versus McDavid head-to-head minutes. And I thought there were multiple instances where I clocked it during the game. Besser and Miller down low with McDavid expending energy trying to check them and the Canucks just having a pretty significant size advantage with just enough skill that if the Oilers got the puck back, it was McDavid wasn't going to have the energy to attack and like put together a full heavy shift. I thought they did an excellent job of that, especially Miller and Besser. There were multiple battles won below the hash marks with either 9 or 6 against 97.
Well, I think the game plan for defending McDavid is so interesting to me because on the one hand, you sort of just have to concede the reality that regardless of what you do, you can have a diligent 60-minute effort, and if you have one slip up, that's all it could take to break a game open. The other thing is that like this was such an uncharacteristically quiet game from McDavid where he had 0 shots on goal, which I think was his first time in the postseason so. He had 1 shot attempt, 0 scoring chances by my count, only 2 set up, which is so low for him. And despite playing 24 minutes, it's going to take a team effort. And I do think, do you remember that one game the Canucks played earlier this year? It was kind of midway through the season, maybe a bit later on. The Avs were in town. I think the Avs actually wound up winning it in overtime. McKinnon scored a couple power play goals. But at 5-on-5, I thought that was the best defensive team effort I'd seen against Nathan McKinnon all year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like such a concerted effort of picking him up early and then almost sandwiching him with a back checker and the person in front of him, even when he didn't have the puck. And it was like, you'll always be in a phone booth. You're never going to get to move freely. And I think that's almost what you have to do here. The issue is that if you like devote so much of that, you can almost take yourself out of your own game. But obviously keeping the puck deep in the zone and just making him kind of taking his legs by making him chase is one way to do so.
Well, it's funny though. The Edmonton Oilers didn't try to like regroup in the neutral zone with McDavid to get him moving much. Like that wasn't something they really went to or tried to implement. They were pretty happy playing a direct style of game, especially I think because they were leading early and then building that lead as the game went on. So I they probably didn't think about it or certainly it wasn't passing the puck around the neutral zone to get McDavid. The puck was not sort of top of the line. The fact that they are hard matching not just Miller against McDavid, but Tyler Myers, Carson Soucy pair, there were definitely moments where McDavid, despite the quiet game, still put that Canucks defensive duo under extreme duress on heavy shifts, right? Where it looked like the Canucks were hanging on by their fingernails. You're always going to be hanging on by your fingernails when you're checking Connor McDavid. So by no means take this as a repudiation of the stellar work. I mean, 10 minutes Myers head-to-head against McDavid, the Oilers had 3 shots in those 10 minutes. I mean, that's a job well done.
Yep.
But if there was sort of one aspect of what the Canucks were able to do against McDavid that I think is going to be almost impossible to replicate, like, that's it right yep. there. You know, Miller versus McDavid, can the Canucks get a similar game as they got in game one a couple more times in the series? Like, I say yes. But that Myers Soucy versus McDavid sort of matchup, and ungranted, they're all checking McDavid as a 5-man unit. I'll fade that. I think that's still going to be an area of concern, an area where I think the Canucks are, it to some extent anyway, covered in oil, and McDavid could well set them on fire. Couple notes on McDavid that McDavid's minutes that I liked. I really love. And I mean, I know they do this, but seeing it live gives you so much better an appreciation for just how different it looks than the way every other team plays. But I love watching in the neutral zone how both Ekholm and Bouchard, and often at the same time, just have a flat-out green light.
Yep.
The moment 97 gets the puck. The moment 97 gets the puck, instead of hanging back with like any thought or care to the risk involved, those guys just shoot up ice and give McDavid extra outlets for give and goes.
Mm.
And like the whole point is for a quick pass and a return pass yep. to get McDavid into the zone. And it's such a smart way to utilize the most singular open ice weapon in the league is just to have like, hey, we have two pretty skilled, pretty good, pretty big defensemen who are just going to join the rush the moment you touch the puck just about every time. Watching that actually in practice and unfold. And again, you see it on TV all the time, you know they do it, but watching it live from, you know, that vantage point where everything looks slow and everything looks easy in the press box, it's just joyful. It's just like, there's no other team that looks like this on the breakout, and I love it so much.
Well, the point you made earlier about what the Oilers were doing schematically in their own zone to try and kind of speed the game up by potentially leaking out a bit more themselves is something to watch for me, not only because of the impact it'll have on the Canucks offense, but because this is such a fascinating matchup from the other perspective of Oilers' cycle offense versus Canucks' D-zone structure, right? Where I think the Oilers were second in the league this year in rush chances, so they certainly got a high volume of them. But despite having the best rush player of all time on their team, when they're at their best, they are a dominant cycle team.
Right.
And against this Canucks defensive zone structure, which is so good at protecting the middle and kind of being a bit more passive in terms of like, they're not chasing up to the point as much as the Hurricanes are with their man-to-man D. They're willing to let you move around and they're just going to protect the slot and block stuff and insulate their goalie. It poses an interesting challenge for the Oilers to sort of break through. They certainly have the players like a Hyman or obviously the passers like Draisaitl and McDavid that can still carve you up if you give them 1 90-second shift after another. Like, they'll find holes in your armor eventually, but I think it does suit them better to find ways to quick attack the way they did with the Hyman goal because it's just not going to be as easy sailing for them, I think, if they kind of are forced to just consistently cycle and generate all of their 5-on-5 offense that way. Because this Canucks team is like, what are we at, 90 games now of them doing this? Like, I'm willing to buy the fact that they're doing something very good that frustrates the living heck out of teams, right?
It's no question.
This isn't like, oh, I don't care what their on-ice save percentage is. Like, this is a real thing in terms of what they're doing to kind of force your hand as the other team's offense.
100%. Well, so I thought the primary thing that surprised me and looked a bit different from what I'd seen the Oilers do previously this season and against the Canucks was I was stunned by how aggressively they pressured up high. Mm. And it wasn't just the point men, although it was functionally directed at the point men. You could notice it too with the way they were super aggressively cutting off the top with even if a forward got the puck up high, like, you know, at the top of the circles or by the half wall, pressure was coming. And I found it interesting because one thing Nashville did was they packed the paint. They played a compact front every shot sort of defensive structure, as we talked about after game one.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, it worked to frustrate the Canucks offense. On the other hand,
it killed their own offense.
It killed their own offense, and the Canucks had the puck the entire series.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was interesting. It feels like the Oilers are providing the Canucks with a dare, right? Like, we'll pressure you up high because, A, if we're able to force a turnover, we're going the other way and we want to attack you off the rush. But, B, you want to just kill time in the offensive zone and make conservative decisions in terms of managing the puck and making plays and, you know, eschewing trying to send hopeful passes for scoring chances and preferring, you know, layered traffic and shots from up high. But if we're going to pressure you like this, there's going to be opportunities down low. Are you even willing to make those passes? Are you willing to try and take those shots knowing that if you miss, A, we've got a forward that's already jailbreaked up high against, you know, one of your slower D or Filip Peronik or Quinn Hughes. And, you know, we're coming at you now. And I think it's an interesting dare. It's like, are you willing to play our game if we give you sort of the first mover advantage? I thought when that game was played in the Oilers' favor in the first half, the pace was really high. I thought it really favored the Oilers. Canucks took over late, and I don't know how much that matters for the rest of the series given how significant the deficit was. But I thought that approach, being willing to surrender a little bit more to the Canucks in order to have the game flow freely and not be played on their terms, I thought that was a fascinating sort of approach, and I think explicitly that's what they're after. I think that's something to watch as this series goes along.
Well, I think it's the correct one, but the other side of it is that it does put more pressure down low
and on Skinner
and on Jeff Skinner, yeah, as you like to call
Jeff
him.
Skinner.
And after game one, I think that's something where it's like, that's something to watch for, right? Not that he was getting beaten on those, the Josh Owen was kind of more of a freaky bounce, but also you are going to get probably into those spots where the Canucks have a 2-on-1 down low more so than otherwise because you have guys up high, right? And so I think it makes sense for them. Like, it's a net positive risk reward because I don't think they necessarily want to play a 2-1 game where they're spending full shifts with McDavid on the ice with the Canucks just loitering at the point. Like, I think they want to speed it up and force the issue. But it does come with a trade-off. It's not necessarily as clean as like, all right, let's just play our way.
I appreciate sometimes when talking about conservative or aggressive hockey, Rick Tuck, it will be like, it's not like we're going to play a 1-4. It's like, no, we know. We know that's not how you're going to play conservative hockey. It's so funny. It's such a funny dynamic where the Canucks play aggressively without the puck. And it's their version of hanging back comes with it. It's such a departure from how we usually think about the game. And I think it's been one of the reasons this team's so different. And I think that's been an edge for them as they've gone through, you know, not just this regular season, but into the playoffs.
I do think this is going to be a big series for the Oilers defensemen one way or another. Like, in game one, we saw sort of the negative. I think we also saw
the positive from the top pair.
Well, and certainly like from Ekholm's shot. And I think those shot opportunities are going to be there because one of the things that happens from the way the Canucks play defensively, and we saw a lot of this, I thought, in the Nashville series, is like on the far side or the weak side, you're almost always, if the defender activates, they will always have a shot available kind of at the top of the circle. And that's just like the byproduct of you have to give up something defensively, and the Canucks allow that. But I think there's going to be a ton of Matthias Ekholm bombs from the point.
Yeah.
And sometimes those goes in, but also sometimes defenseman efficiency at scoring doesn't go in, and then you get into troubles.
And not just bombs. That guy has so much control over where the puck is going when he winds up for a slap shot. You can even notice it on clears. If you're really paying attention to Matthias Ekholm, like, even on clears, sometimes, you know, guys wind up or whatever, and you're like, oh, this could be interesting, right? Or, like, there's a chance it's not going out of the zone, or chance that it's going over the glass, and it's like, I find you can even notice him like wind up at like 75% or 50% or just like half mast slappers, and it feels like he has perfect control. He hit Seelov's top corner on a perfect half slap on his goal. It was actually an absolute thing of beauty, and exactly what, you know, one thing that I've always enjoyed about watching him play is it just feels like he has way more control over his slap shot than your average. Almost like, you know, those golf video games where it's like he sets the speed and sets like where he's hitting the ball. And it's just like, it's super fun to watch.
Yeah. All right, let's take our break here. And then when we come back, we'll jump right back in and keep chatting about the series with Thomas Drantz. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here on the PDOcast. Tom, let's keep it going. Do you want to talk? I'll give you the choice here. We're going to talk about them both, but I'll give you the order. Do you want to talk Pettersson and his line, or do you want to talk about Draisaitl? Because I think both are obviously very big talking points.
Can I go off the board first? Just like a really quick one?
Sure.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. I always used to love watching Marian Hossa play because I thought of him as like I'm second straight video game reference for me is not ideal, but as like the Mario character from Mario Kart or Mario Party, like he was big enough to overpower the little guys and he was fast enough to be faster than the big guys, and famously watched a ton of video, was just like a famously intelligent two-way player. And I always used to love watching Marian Hossa play, not just because he was amazing and did amazing stuff, but because I always tried to learn from the way that he'd attack defenders.
Right.
It was like the Marian Hossa test. Can you pass it? Can you not? What does he think? Where does he think you're vulnerable? And I had never considered this until game one, but watching Zach Hyman, not that Zach Hyman is a Hall of Fame player like Marian Hossa, but I do wonder if Zach Hyman's maybe the closest proximity that we have today to guy who's big enough to beat little guys with his size, fast enough to beat big guys with his feet, skilled enough to attack, you know, the heels of defenders that maybe are a little bit more clumsy. And if you actually just watch how he goes about attacking various players, you might learn a lot about what he thinks, what one of the smartest guys in the league thinks about how and where his opponents are vulnerable. And I noticed that he had this unbelievable entry where he literally put his shoulder into Hronek, maybe a step over the blue line, and then just like used that and almost circled the net. And it was just this thing where it was like so telling about where he thought his advantages were on Hronek. And likewise, his goal, which was a bounce off Tyler Myers' stick, he's immediately attacking Myers' heels.
Yes.
Immediately. He's just like, you're huge, your reach is big, but if I'm just like skating at a point at the back of your feet, you're going to have trouble sort of crossing over and staying with me. And he was right. That to me, it just a credit to where this guy's gotten to as a player that I'd even think about him this way. But I also just thought it was incredibly revealing to just watch him move about the ice and attack various Canucks players using different sort of weapons in the toolkit. Man, he's become a totally different guy than he was 5-6 years ago.
Certainly.
It's awesome.
No, his game has grown so much. He's a stud. And listen, I will never on this program get mad at anyone for dropping Marian Hossa references. I will say, though, and it speaks to how much, like how far the game has come, where I just think there's so many players now that have such multifaceted offensive arsenals that they can be, like, I would even argue, like, not that Mikko Rantanen is a burner, but like, if you get him in a one-on-one against a defender, even if the defender is a really smooth skating defenseman, if he gets in an awkward pivot where he exposes his heels, Rantanen is absolutely going to target you and pick you apart.
Yeah.
There's just so many guys like that now that also that have like the physicality to put their shoulder down and attack you, but can also off the rush burn you. And so, yeah, the game is in a great place.
In a great place
regard.
For that, yeah.
Once again, Tom, Pettersson or Draisaitl?
Okay, let's go Pettersson.
Okay.
So he picked his teeth with the Ryan McLeod line at 5-on-5. The Canucks used him more than any other forward in the third period, especially, and his ice time spiked especially after the Canucks took the 5-4 lead. So clear defensive value there. He had 5 hits, so that, you know, for a player who's been dogged by speculation about their injured status and had missed practice the day before, that's a good sign that he was assertive and comfortable physically.
He was, but we can't reference hits.
We can't reference real-time stats on this program.
I just think in game two, like Barkov had like 9 or 10 hits. And he had an awesome game.
Yeah.
I'm.
You think he got some for playing knick-knack paddywhack?
I think a couple were maybe. He was in the vicinity, and it was like, all right, well, okay. He's a big guy.
My point is he looked physically unencumbered.
Yes.
And to me, the number of hits more than anything
for
just
sure.
was like a numerical
The physical
involvement
for sure is notable. Yeah.
And then for me, the most important thing, and it's not like his shot attempts were through the roof. I think he had four on the game. He had three shots on goal, so at least he was getting them through. Early in the series against Nashville, those first two games, he had 15 shot attempts. You'd have to find me the video on that. I can't even remember them. But it's because they were all blocked. He wasn't getting his shot through against Nashville defenders. Maybe that like impacted his confidence. Maybe, I don't know. But it felt like Pettersson's such a savvy dual threat producer, right? He's never going to be a high shot volume guy because temperamentally that's not how he sees the game. Pettersson's not out there looking for his shot or looking for a goal. He's out there to make the right play, right? Like that's just true to who he is, right? And that's been frustrating, I think, as he's looked so non-threatening throughout the playoffs to this point. It felt like the shot was prioritized like way higher in his decision-making tree in game one. So you saw decisively takes a one-timer on the power play off of a really nice cross-seam feed from JT Miller, misses, but the point was it was his only miss of the game. But it was the sort of one-timer we just hadn't seen him even try in the playoffs to this point, and he took it with zero hesitation, right? Like, he leaned into it, he got a lot of it, he missed by a foot, maybe a half foot, but like, if he keeps taking those and if he's willing to take those, if he's not willing to take those, he doesn't exert gravity. Like, no one has the space that they need on the power play. He literally, whether he's scoring or not, he needs to be launching those when the look makes sense. And then he also had the wrist shot off the rush pretty aggressively against Skinner that handcuffed him. He was able to fight it off. I just thought Pettersson was getting to his shot a little bit faster without necessarily. Here's the thing, too. When he's playing with Hoglander and Mikheyev, it's like you shooting is always the right decision. But I just don't. I think it's inimical to how
he
plays.
Wired, yeah, we knew heading into the series, especially in the home games, he would get all of the bottom six matchups he could handle, right?
Yeah.
Like, it was like, that's just going to be the head-to-head.
These matchups literally unfolded exactly as we would have expected them.
But I think the bigger thing is it was also primarily against Desharnais, who I thought looked very slow in that matchup, and the Kulak pair, right? Not that CeCe and Nurse are defensive titans by any means, but that is a pairing you should theoretically be able to win. And we saw a lot of territorial dominance. Now, the issue for me is, despite all that, you mentioned how Pettersson's never going to be a volume guy. He's always going to be an efficiency driver. And I think that's what makes it so maddening that he's playing all these ships with arguably the least efficient offensive player in the league right now. Like, Ilya Mikheyev has one goal in his past 57 games. I look back into regular season.
Oh, yeah.
And in the playoffs, he has, I've got him up to like 16 or 17 scoring chances so far. And on the one hand, I'm trying to remove subjectivity out of my tracking. So like, if you get a good look, I'm giving it to you. It's also one of those like expected by whom type of situations where it's like, yeah, this is theoretically a scoring chance. Did I ever believe it was actually going to lead to a goal? Not really.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating because it's tough to knock when it's like, all right, you're spending the entire game in the offensive zone. You're threatening the other team. You're keeping, as we said, whoever you're playing against pinned. And then that has like a snowball effect where other guys come on the ice, they're in an advantageous position, you keep going. But man, it's just so frustrating.
Well, he hit the post in game one. He hit a post off of a rebound.
Yeah.
Just like one of those classic like Canucks long range bombs that becomes a close range chance that Mikheyev spoils, right? Yeah. It's just like you couldn't write a more Canucks specific line. 3-4 months ago I was saying that, you know, my understanding was, and I'd made the calls and I'd done the work, and my understanding around the league was like, hey, you know, I still think Mikheyev will have value around the league just based on his two-way chops, his size, the regard for his defensive game, a relatively widespread understanding that, you know, a player's first year back from ACL surgery, right? Surgery to repair an ACL tear. You might not get their fastball. And I saw a Canucks fan on Twitter reference, like, Drant says he still has trade value. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I said that when he'd had one goal in 25 games.
Yeah. 30, 32 games later.
Yeah, once we get into one goal in 60 game territory, I think that logic, you know, not that I've done the work to like update. I'll do it after the season. I'm a little too focused on the playoffs. But yeah, I mean, things change quickly when you score that little while playing that many minutes in the top six with Elias Pettersson, fixture on power play too. I mean, it's pretty hard to wrap your head around.
Now, when people around the league were saying he had value, were you speaking with Cal Dubas? He'd be a great fit on that Penguins offense.
Would he? Yeah. I mean, the Leafs didn't even try to retain him.
Bro, have you seen their 5-on-5 expected goal share? They're playing pretty good hockey.
Hoglander, too, has not been... He's not leveled up the way that you'd have hoped.
It's gone better. Like, the start of the playoffs was, like, just he wasn't...
He's still sticky along the wall. Yes. And, like, he's still, you know, annoying on the forecheck. But, you know, there's still growth to his game. I think it's little skill plays to help Pettersson drive that are lacking with him. And just a reminder, too, that while, you know, he was, like, top 10 5-on-5 goal scorer this year, stuff like that, he shot, like, 25%.
Yes.
And that's gonna make a player look pretty different in terms of their offensive capability than they actually are. I've always been Team Hoglander. Like I'm a big fan of his game overall and I believe in his impact, but there's growth in what he has to do with the puck in terms of what he sees as a playmaker. We're watching a lot of these minutes and it feels like Pettersson is not getting the sort of service that he can actually cook with.
Yeah.
In addition to the fact that he's struggled for most of this playoffs.
Yes.
It's like both things have been true the whole time, but
it's only magnifying it, yeah.
Right, but on Wednesday anyway, with Pettersson's form looking more recognizably Pettersson, you know, I do think it looked... I do think it sort of threw into starker relief the line mate question.
Okay, we got to talk Dreisaitl because we got 10 minutes left here, and that's the elephant in the room in terms of his status and his health. And it's just a bummer because... Round one, he was just unbelievable. I thought he was probably the best player league-wide that I watched in round one. The start of this game, he was cooking in the first period, right?
So like, cool.
He had a couple of puck receptions kind of around the blue line neutral zone where he like reaches back, pulls it between his legs, inside-out move, rush to the net, creates a scoring chance, gets the puck by the side of the net.
Jedi mind tricks Ian Cole to even get it. And then
gets it over to Ekholm.
Well, how many players, 99.9% of NHL players, are immediately putting that directly into a goalie's pads.
All of them.
Yeah, and Leon Draisaitl is like, I'm going to thread a low to high pass through four defenders.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. It's so cool.
No, it was so cool. And I thought in particular in round one, like, you just saw the activity defensively off the puck as well, where he was just playing such a well-rounded game. And you could tell that he was visibly... hampered, like he missed a significant stretch of it being in the room, and then when he came back in the third, and after the game, they were like, "Oh, equipment issue slash cramping,"
and then
not available the next day for the skate or whatever.
Yeah, and
in between,
and now questionable for tonight.
So we'll see.
I would guess, though, just like it, you know, I would guess based on the fact that it was Sam Gagner on the second line at Oilers practice. It's not like they reconfigured their lineups. It looked like a placeholder. I would assume, well, you know
it's
what?
A hockey player in the playoffs, man.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's move on, though, also, because everyone's going to be listening to this after they already know.
Yeah, so we'll see, but I will say, he comes back in the third, and he had the sequence, I think it might have been his first shift back, so maybe give him a little bit of leeway, because he was cold, like he hadn't played in such a long period of time, but...
Didn't look like he was driving.
Pettersson had the puck on the wall, he kind of goes to engage him, and Pettersson gives him a little reverse check, and the reaction was a very ginger one. By him, and then later in that sequence, Pettersson just dashes towards the net. I think Hronek hits him with a pass, and it just misses being a tap-in, but Draisaitl was just slow on that.
That was the tip that he beat,
And he was just slow to get there, and I was like, that's not great. And then later he fell. I think that was a skate issue, but it was like...
And he got cross-checked. Just, I mean, Nikita Zadorov understood the assignment.
Well, man, Zadorov. And speaking of talking to people around the league and his value, you know there's NHL GMs watching this right now doing the Vince McMahon, like, ooh, like where he's like sitting in the chair getting progressively more like aroused.
Cross checks the player in the spot he knows he's probably hurt and then scores.
the stretch pass also for the Garland goal.
That's
but
right.
Also,
cult hero.
The way he's moving, like bombing from the point, just the physical, all of it is like... a GM's just wet dream. Like, it's unbelievable. Right. So you know that,
he's so cool, though.
It's so fun to watch. I mean, so fun. The goal he scored against the Predators in game, what was it, four? Man. Like, it was unbelievable. Just awesome. But yeah, Dreisaitl, I think the concern here is we've seen him in the past and previous postseasons, even at well less than 100%, still be effective because he's so stationary on the power play that he can still, from that dead angle, score, but also distribute the puck. And as always, you just got to account for him when he's on the ice. The issue, though, is in those series, because he was limited in terms of his movement, they had to play him with McDavid 5-on-5 because he just couldn't carry his own line.
Mm-hmm.
And then what that does is a domino effect the rest of this lineup, I think, is concerning and something to watch. Very. Because a big reason why they've been so scary is you had McDavid and Hyman just crushing at 5-on-5. Then you had Dreisaitl crushing at 5-on-5. And then that allows you to have McLeod and Fogle and Holloway and all these other guys in the bottom six. If you remove that and kind of compress the top line, all of a sudden then I think the Canucks would feel really good about multiple matchups beyond just like one here or there.
I do think, though, that that's still the answer. Like, at the end of the day, if Ilya Mikheyev is going to beat you, Ilya Mikheyev's going to beat you. Like, that's going to have to be the choice that the Oilers are comfortable making. And honestly, it's not one they should hesitate to sort of court. You know, it sounds scary when it's like, well, then, you know, so you're going to bump Dreisaitl up to first line left wing. You're going to put Ryan Nugent-Hopkins in the middle, and you're going to move one of McLeod, Fogle, or Holloway up, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the answer.
Yep.
And probably you don't want to move McLeod up because you want some sort of engine on the third line. Yep. Okay. So you're weakening your second line against Lindholm, but like, are you really that worried about Phil DiGiuseppe, Sam Lafferty, Teddy Blue? Like, take your medicine, man. You know, that's not a matchup the Oilers can afford to be mindful of. They just need to make their minutes against the Miller line and the Lindholm line count. Like, period. That's it. In my view, anyway. And I honestly think that's something they should consider going to anyway. Like, I think McDavid might need the help, and he certainly might need the help down low. And that's also sort of, I guess, where you get into the concern of, like, can Dreisaitl help him down low in terms of adding to what the McDavid line can drive? Because we know even if he's physically limited, he still can help McDavid produce.
No, he certainly can. I think the complicating thing is that even when he's feeling his absolute best, I would describe his skating stride as looking ginger and uncomfortable. And so it's like almost difficult to know, like, you're trying to, like, Zapruder style look at the film and you're like going frame by frame and you're like, I don't know, his knee flexion there didn't look quite
his
as
knee
and
flexion.
And then all of a sudden it's like, I don't know, this is how he usually looks. I can't really tell. I know this old
dude. They need him. They need him. But I
especially
think,
because of how he had been playing previously, right? This isn't a thing where it's like he was struggling and then it's like, all right, whatever, what's going to be the difference? It's like he was their best player.
Yeah.
And so now
you can't hesitate, though. You cannot hesitate to thin out your lineup if you're the Oilers. You're down in the series now. McDavid, you know, and Dreisaitl can cook 5-on-5 even if Dreisaitl's not at 100%, and you're going to need those minutes to count. You know, it's leaving Dreisaitl on the second line. It's not like you have an edge in the McLeod matchup as it stands.
Right.
You know, it's not like the problem in the Lindholm matchup is the defensive play of, you know, Evander Kane and the fact that Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is probably, like, he can still do the job at center.
The issue, though, like I said, though, was part of the reason they're able to get by is because they just have Dreisaitl play with Nurse and CeCe,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden now if that defensive pair is playing minutes with someone significantly worse, all of a sudden now I think they're just so much more exploitable than
so much more vulnerable.
And I think there's like a cascade. Like,
there is domino effect.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, I know they're loath to do it, but I'll be curious to see if at some point the Canucks, like, you'll know the Canucks have really taken the initiative in this series if they can split Bouchard Ekholm. That's going to be like the canary in the coal mine to look for in terms of the Oilers need to find an answer. But yeah, I mean, everything we're talking about from Dreisaitl to Nurse CeCe on and on, I mean, it really does sort of put a microscope or a magnifying glass on the fact that, like, the Lindholm-Garland line is really the key to this series for Vancouver.
That's a perfect bow on this. You brought it right back to the starting topic. We should also note Oilers first power play, 40 seconds in on the too many men score. And then that was the last one they had all game. So I think that is also, when you're talking about the story of game one and what 100%. To look for, I think it may be a different story if they get a few more opportunities along the way. So we'll see how that unfolds. Tom, everyone can check out your coverage of the series at The Athletic. Also listen to Canucks Talk here on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Thanks for the plugs, bro.
This was great, man. We'll have you on again soon. Enjoy the rest of the series. Thank you to everyone for listening. Pop into the Discord. The invite link is in the show notes. Go smash the 5-star button wherever you listen. And that's all for this episode with Tom. We will be back with one more here to close out the week. So looking forward to that. Thank you for listening to the Hockey PDO Cast, streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.